Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Some months ago, we interviewed a former Jet Propulsion Laboratory employee, David Coppedge, who was the lead administrator for many years, responsible for the ground computers for the Cassini-Saturn mission at JPL, about some amazing scientific discoveries we discussed. David is also on the board of Illustra Media, the organization that makes those tremendous intelligent design videos that we sell through our Real Science Radio online store. You just go to rsr.org and click on the store and browse our science department. It's so much fun. And I'm currently reading a great book by David's father titled Evolution, Possible or Impossible by James Coppedge. And so this father and son have played an important role in the creation movement. But what I'd really like to talk to David about are some of the headlines that he's been reporting on right now at his website, crev.info, crev.info. That's Creation Evolution Headlines. So what an honor to welcome back to Real Science Radio, David Coppedge. Hello, David.
Hi, nice to be on the show today.
Well, it's so great, and you've got such a wonderful homepage there, so many powerful articles. The headlines I'm hoping we could discuss have to do with dark matter, new human bones that once again throw the theory of evolution into disarray, and then those fun accounts that you've been writing about, the just-so stories promoted by Darwinist scientists. Maybe we could begin with that and the one about insect wings from a very prestigious scientific journal.
Sure. Just-so stories are the name that Rudyard Kipling gave to some bedtime stories for children. And it's a bad habit of a lot of Darwinists to tell similar stories, like Kipling had how the camel got its hump and how the leopard got its spots and other just fanciful tales. But we find evolutionists doing the same types of just-so stories today.
Well, a very well-known science writer has pointed this out. You mentioned him in your sequel article to the one I just referenced, but Richard Lewontin, you recall his quote?
Yeah, he talked about the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories.
Yeah, and he's an evolutionist, so of course he accepts those just-so stories, but it's really nice for him to acknowledge that that's what's going on.
Yes, and he accepts it because he has a prior commitment to materialism.
So this first just-so story that I'd like us to discuss that you write about has to do with how insects got their wings, and it is in a very prestigious scientific journal. I mean, these kinds of stories are not only in high school textbooks.
Right. These are in major scientific journals like the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Well, in the PNAS article, what they did was they got certain defective wings to grow on the thorax by tinkering with genes, see? And so they got some damaged wings to appear in other places on the thorax of a fruit fly.
So, David, from a biological point of view, molecular biology, exploring how organisms function, I mean, that's pretty significant to be able to move some genes around. And then see that, well, look what I've done. I just broken this insect, but he's trying to grow these deformed wings out of other parts of his body. I mean, at that level, that's rather interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. And it's a lot of times this affects what are called Hox genes, which are regulatory genes in development. And so you can get legs and wings to appear in the wrong place or to be shriveled up or damaged because you're affecting the point in development where they develop, but that doesn't mean evolution.
Well, of course not, right.
The authors say these innovations account for the major features of insect wing origin and diversification, which is phony.
So what a grandiose conclusion that they're making, right? what the fact that we could tinker with these Hox genes and get legs to sprout out of an insect's head, maybe, the fact that we can do that accounts for the origin of insect wings or legs or body parts. That form of argument is an absurdity, yet it's a perfect example, a common example of what passes for an explanation at the highest levels of the scientific Darwinian community.
Yeah, and you know why that happens is because there's no debate allowed. It's just an accepted fact that Darwinism is true, and therefore we're going to make up a story to fit any observation into this belief. And since nobody's allowed to debate it or critique it, they get away with it.
So if somebody took software and they went into the software code of some program, some app on their computer, and they copied it, they made copies, they changed it a little bit, and then the app was broken, that doesn't tell you how the app was created in the first place. That tells you how you can break the app. That's what it tells you.
Exactly. And I think some evolutionists would think it would be progress if you went into an infinite loop of some kind.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a good point. So at any rate, this isn't saying anything about how the genes that code for wings, for the building of wings, how they originated. It's just showing how they could be broken as we intervene. So that's the first article on how insects got their wings. It does remind me of a book that an ophthalmologist, professor of ophthalmology at the University of California, recommended I read on how eyes evolved, written by one of his associates. And so I went and got that book before this professor and I debated. That debate is online at rsr.org/i. But when the UPS driver delivered this book, it cost about $100, this fancy textbook. On the cover was How Eyes Evolved. I wrote immediately in the inside cover, this book will have nothing to do with how eyes evolved. It'll only be an anatomy book. And then I had my wife and my kids sign it as witnesses. And that's what the whole book is. It's a gorgeous anatomy book that has virtually nothing to say about how eyesight might evolve. Virtually nothing.
Wow. You know, I see that a lot, too. And in this Pinaz article, I don't complain about the actual laboratory experiments that they run.
Right.
It's the conclusion that they draw, that this somehow tells about insect wing origin and diversification,
yeah,
which it doesn't.
The unjustified conclusion, which is accepted. Then the next article, it's about not an insect, but a fish. And it's fish species that could evolve very quickly. Can we talk about that, the sticklebacks?
Yeah, they claim that since the 1964 earthquake in Alaska, that certain sticklebacks have, in just 50 generations, have undergone detectable changes. Mm. But again, you know, these are just minor changes in the amount of armor that they have or the amount of spines they have. It's not a fish growing legs or wings or anything like that.
Right. It's never new organs. It's like if you breed dogs and you could go from a Great Dane down to a Chihuahua, it's the same species, but there's tremendous genetic diversity within the genome, and it's being expressed based on all kinds of factors. And so here they see a very rapid response of the stickleback to their environment. And to them, it's astonishing because it's not Darwinian evolution, because that should be random and it should take thousands of years. But this is very rapid and it's repeated, and they draw some very interesting conclusions from the stickleback experience.
Yeah, they're pulling way too much rabbit out of the hat here. They talk about the intriguing hypothesis that most stickleback evolution in freshwater occurs within the first few decades after invasion of a novel environment. Well, you know, the evolution they're talking about is very minor, and we as creationists would certainly think it to be a design feature that there's enough robustness in a genome to allow an organism to adapt to a changed environment. And that's not evolution. That's a pre-programmed design feature.
Well, and it happens, they point out, you have a fabulous excerpt from their paper. They point out that this kind of change is recent, it's rapid, it's repeated, and there is this colonization. In fact, because it's repeated, this independent colonization of freshwater habitats by oceanic ancestors. So when this happens over and over, you take a species, even if it's bacteria, and you introduce some kind of antibiotic like penicillin, and you see that it responds, and there's a resistant strain that's produced almost instantly. And then you do the same experiment with another colony of the bacteria and another, and you do it 100 times over, and you get this immediate response and development of resistant strains. What that's telling me is that this is something built into the genome originally, and it's being expressed. And in fact, David, the authors of this paper, they pretty much come out and say that almost explicitly, that that seems to be what's going on here. That here's what they say. This species maintains a large pool of genetic variation that can be redeployed rapidly.
Exactly. Yeah. In other words, it's already there. It's not evolving. It's absent. It's already there. It's a pool of variation that can be redeployed depending on the environment. So that's a design feature, not evolution.
Right. And that's key. I think that statement of theirs is concise, and it's a key to understanding so much of the diversity that evolutionists desperately claim to be evidence for Darwinism and origin of species, because they have virtually no evidence. So even when they see that this information for this diversification is pre-existing and it could be deployed almost on demand, they still call it evidence for Darwinism when it's simply evidence for pre-existing information within a species.
Yeah, exactly. I talk about how scientists so often take evidence for design, and yet they mount it in Darwin's trophy case as if it's for evolution. And so, yeah, here's a design feature that you've got organisms that can adapt. And we know from the epigenetic revolution that's going on, where things, in addition to genes, can respond to the environment and switch genes on and off and regulate them, that this is something that is contrary to the mutation selection ideas of Darwin.
David, epigenetics, in the half century now since Watson and Crick co-discovered the DNA double helix, the focus by Darwinists has been on the nucleotides in genes. And it turns out, you just mentioned epigenetics, there are so many different types of information that are so significant in not only the development of an organism, but the operation of a cell. And all of that just adds to the wild complexity that's all interfaced to have a living organism. It's almost as though the Darwinian theory, even the neo-Darwinian modern synthesis, where they took Darwin's ideas and they put molecular biology into it, even that now is so rudimentary, it's virtually juvenile in its attempt to explain the diversity of life.
Yeah, young people might say it's so 1930s.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, back to the biblical account that God created us, and in Genesis, there's an extended report on the global flood, and there are evolutionists or skeptics who have said, well, if there was a global flood, then the fish, all the freshwater fish would have died because the whole earth flooded and it would have been salt water. This is a great example right here of how fish have this ability within their genome, and they could express either freshwater or saltwater survival abilities. And it could be, you mentioned that epigenetics might flip a switch, a genetic switch. It could be, even like with variation within the human race and different ethnicities, it could be that a switch is switched on or off permanently. And so you might have a saltwater species that's never going to go back to freshwater, or freshwater that can never go back to saltwater. But we could see in the architecture of these living creatures that that kind of functionality was there to start with.
Yes, and we can see this happening as salmon go from freshwater to saltwater. I mean, there are major changes that have to take place. They'll spend a few days at the mouth of the river adjusting to saltwater, and there are things that happen in the cells in their gills and in their kidneys and throughout their body to prepare for the change in environment.
Wow.
But it happens every year.
Wow. In fact, you guys, Elestra Media, produced this tremendous film, Living Waters, Intelligent Design in the Oceans of the Earth. And the story of salmon is part of this film. David, I mean, we cheered when we saw this film, Living Waters. Just so fabulous. And you're involved in the production of these videos, is that right?
Yeah, the producer put my name as associate producer this time, which is a little bit of a stretch there. But I was involved in researching a lot of the science discussed in the film, such as the salmon and the way they adjust to salt water and the way that they smell such small concentrations of odors coming from their birth river, things like that.
Yeah, just astounding. And then you guys have also produced Flight, The Genius of Birds, and Metamorphosis on the Beauty and Design of Butterflies, and so many other fabulous videos. If anyone listening to us, if they've not seen those videos, David, I mean, I couldn't more highly recommend them. Have you found a way to urge people who have never seen these videos to get off the couch and go get them?
Well, they can certainly go to illustramedia.com or go to our Facebook page or YouTube channel, and you can see samples on our YouTube channel if you look for Illustra Media. In fact, some of our earlier films are there in their entirety, but you can see the trailers and excerpts from these films. And yeah, we're very proud of them and eager to get them known.
Yeah, they're just tremendous. All right, with these just-so stories about how Darwinism brought about all these wonderful features of living creatures, there's then the dog, man's best friend, and how the dog learned to drink. Now,
yes,
this is...
How the dog learned to drink.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a great design story about how, with their tongue, they can lift a whole column of water effectively into their mouth using a very precise method. So it looks sloppy, but it's actually very effective.
It's like in your video on Flight, when you guys looked at the hummingbird and how the hummingbird draws nectar out of a flower. The animation in that, David, it was stunning beyond measure to see what the Lord hath made.
Oh, yeah, that was one of our favorite excerpts there. And we've learned a little bit since the film was made. For instance, when the tongue goes out of the beak, it actually squeezes the nectar into the beak as the tongue is being extended. The scientists that discovered that have done additional work that adds to the design.
So when somebody watches that 1 60-second portion of that video, they will have had no idea that a hummingbird hovering over a flower and sucking out nectar could be so incredibly sophisticated in all the moving parts and how dramatic it all is. And so now you come to a dog and it looks like he's making a mess, right? He might be making a mess, slurping up from his bowl. But the sophistication there with the laws of physics and how the dog's tongue is able to implement this incredible action, it is extraordinary. And so, of course, now PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, of course, they have to say something about how this evolved, don't they?
Oh, yeah. First, they talk about it being a precise method, and they even call it acceleration-driven open pumping. It sounds pretty elaborate there.
Yeah.
But then they have to tell the just-so story. They say, animals that interact with an air-fluid interface have evolved highly specialized behaviors, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So they have to just say it evolved, and that's sufficient to them to just end the story right there. It evolved.
So they have this obligatory gloss they have to throw in about Darwin, give a nod to Darwin. But in their research, where they learned so much more about how a dog drinks, did any of it help us better understand how Darwinism could have produced this behavior Apparently, in the paper, there was nothing that helped them get an insight into how this could have originated.
No, it's just like a narrative added on, and it doesn't add anything to the science. In fact, the science points to design that we would like to imitate in our own engineering.
Biomimetics. Because the great designer, the creator, Jesus Christ, in his brilliance, his omnicompetence, he was able to make these extraordinary designs that our best engineers are looking at in awe today. And in
omnicompetence, I like that. I hadn't heard that word as one of God's attributes, but that's good.
Yeah, omnicompetence. And so we have our greatest engineers who produce amazing technology, and yet they look at what are considered to be the simplest living organisms, and they have wildly complex and sophisticated functionality and design.
So, yeah, I like reporting on biomimetics. On my website, there's a category of biomimetics, and you can look at literally hundreds of examples of design in nature that is inspiring engineers and scientists to try to imitate it.
Yes, right. So maybe we could speed up with a couple more examples of the Just So stories, because you went on to do a sequel to that article, The Farce Awakens, More Just So Stories. So there's rays, like manta rays in the sea, and how they got their flapping motions of their wings, you know, if you want to refer to them as wings. And so that's interesting. From Science Daily, they're going to help us understand how this evolved.
Oh, yeah, they're just going to say it evolved. It evolved from an ancient lineage of shark that dramatically altered its body plan to adapt to life on ocean or river bottoms. Well, you know, did they do that by intelligent design, or did they do that according to a Kipling Just So story?
Yeah, so there are these magic words that just appear anywhere from the public science press, like National Geographic or Discover Magazine, right up through the world's most prestigious journals, and they just say, and evolution did it. And evolution
did
it.
And it evolved.
It did it. And they talk, then you pull out an article from Science Daily on how the beetle avoided evolution. And that's interesting because they're looking at a beetle that has been preserved, they believe, in tree resin for about 100 million years.
Yes, and yet it managed to remain so exquisitely intact after almost a million centuries of existence. So you can tell that it's a predator much like modern relatives.
This is so common, too. There's a medical doctor, Dr. Carl Werner, who's produced these beautiful DVDs, Living Fossils, and he gives so many examples, also in his beautiful book by the same title, Living Fossils, of species that are around today, like the shrimp, that are identical, when you look at them, to a fossil shrimp from tens of millions of years ago or older, and it hasn't changed at all, yet the evolutionist will give it a completely different scientific name. That bimodal name, they change both to imply that it's some different species.
Right, and yet you put them side by side and they look identical. Yeah, Werner does great work, and that's astonishing. In other words, you have vast periods of stasis where nothing evolved, and yet this is supposed to be this ongoing, slow, gradual improvement of species over time.
So what the fossil record really shows us is extinction and stasis. That's what it shows us. Stasis and extinction. Then there's a funny little bit, David, and we're speaking with David Coppedge of Crev.info, Creation Evolution Headlines, so CREV.info, INFO, how the salamander got in touch with its inner fish. And that's sort of, I mean, somebody could say that's a little rude of you to put it that way, but this famous evolutionist wrote a book about our inner fish.
Yeah, that's Neil Shubin. He was the one that found Tiktaalik, that supposed ancestor between fish and tetrapods.
Right. The alleged missing link, so that where fish began to walk. But the problem for that organism is that we've found footprints of tetrapods millions of years before Tiktaalik lived. And so that threw that into the has-beens of intermediary species.
Well, that's similar to this case here, because salamanders are already tetrapods, okay? They've already got feet, so So how is it that they can say that strolling salamanders provide clues on how animals evolved to move from water to land?
Then maybe one last example from this category is how the birds survived the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs. How about that? That's always been a question I've had.
Yeah, you've got delicate little birds, Tweety birds and stuff, that survive this catastrophe that wiped out the largest and strongest animals of their time. So that's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it?
Yeah, and dinosaurs, I mean, they were all sizes. Most dinosaurs were small, like maybe the size of a household pet.
They're all over the Earth, too. So why didn't the asteroid hit the ones on one side of the Earth and not the other? And how did the birds survive the same catastrophe?
And birds have been around for millions of years, according to the evolutionists. This is all presuming their geologic column time frame. And so what a great argument against the claim that it was an asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs, or a meteorite.
Yeah, I think so. And they talk about birds going across land bridges, and I'm wondering, why didn't they just fly? They fly across oceans today. So
right.
Who needs a land bridge when you're a bird?
So, David, I had mentioned a couple other topics, just maybe two others. Dark matter. The need for dark matter is almost desperate for the astrophysics community, because if there is no dark matter, then our observations that we make with the world's greatest telescopes, those in orbit and terrestrial telescopes, then their observations all falsify the Big Bang. The Big Bang is not true based on our observations, so dark matter and other dark entities, like dark energy and dark radiation and so on, have been proposed in order to save the theory. So now for decades, scientists have been looking for evidence of dark matter, for actual evidence of its existence. And so what's the latest on that?
Well, the world's most sensitive detector turned in its latest results and found nothing. And so here you have not only the United States, but Europe and China and other countries are spending fortunes trying to look for mysterious particles that nobody knows what they are or what their properties are, but they must be there. So it's almost like the occult, you know. It's imagining mysterious forces. Maybe it's the force. I don't know.
In fortunes, billions of dollars have been spent trying to understand how the Big Bang could have produced the first particles of the universe, which we here at Real Science Radio, and I know that you do at Krev.info, we reject that the Big Bang theory is valid. In fact, David, we're so thrilled with how well, this is a little bit of bragging here, but when people search for Big Bang topics, boy, our articles, we got two articles on the topic that rank right up at the top of the first page. NASA says it's the predictions of the Big Bang that confirm the theory, and they list three predictions. And so if anyone Googles, and this is anywhere in the world, if they Google Big Bang predictions, out of over a million web pages that Google says are relevant, we rank number one out of those million pages with our article on the predictions of the Big Bang.
And that's quite an achievement, Gus.
It's really thrilling. And then also, this is a bit more obvious, but if people search for evidence against the Big Bang, we rank typically in the top three or four out of like 10 million pages that Google thinks are relevant. Evidence against the Big Bang in the top three or four. And so we have been following this for years now at Real Science Radio, this whole area of science. And we've updated our article with a link to your article, Dark Matter Lost in Space. So at rsr.org/Big Bang, thank you so much for alerting us to this, the new results from the world's most sensitive dark matter detector, and the new results are nothing. You summed it up very succinctly.
That's right. And I'm not ruling out that maybe they'll find a candidate for dark matter someday, but my problem is that how long do you give them to look? I mean, you give them 10,000 years to search for dark matter before saying, hey, there isn't any? And think of all the millions of dollars of taxpayer money being spent by people who will never know the answer. I mean, it seems to me you got to put a time limit on something like this, or else find your own money to do it.
Find your own money. You know, there's something interesting, David. I think this is like psychological observation. As long as the governments of the world, the politically correct governments of the world, think that basic science is going to help affirm the materialist worldview, they'll keep pouring billions of dollars into this fundamental science that is so important to us Christians, to us creationists. But there might come a time when they realize that the more they discover and the more they understand the fundamental laws of science, that the argument against atheistic origins is just being decimated. And that might actually provide a downward pressure on the amount of money governments are willing to spend in the future on science.
Well, I hope so. I actually have a sort of a positive hope that the interest in biomimetics is going to just trump Darwinism, and I think more scientists are going to realize that, wow, nature's designs are so good and so exquisite, and they'll get more excited about that, and the Darwin stories will just sort of drop off like autumn leaves.
Well, that's a really positive way of looking at this concern that I have. So then last thing, could we talk about the discovery of bones in China that are causing this incredible turmoil in the hearts and minds of anthropologists and paleontologists?
Well, you know, I've been reporting about early man finds for 15 years now, and it's like every year or two, something comes out. Well, they'll basically say everything you know is wrong.
Right.
And this is a good example of that, where they found these bones in China that look like early Homo bones, like Homo erectus, and yet they're saying they're only 10 to 14,000 years old, which is totally against the usual story.
Right. So this paper and this research was led by a scientist from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. And they're saying that, well, this species from 2 million years ago, we have these individuals from the species who were around just 14,000 years ago. And they say this is a truly global importance, this find. And once again, what we see, we're the home of the list of not so old things. We see that something that was claimed to be millions of years ago, there's going to be evidence increasingly. In fact, every day there are discoveries like this, not only of hominids, but of all organisms. There's going to be evidence that these processes happen rapidly or these organisms lived recently. That's the trend, and the trend is everywhere we look.
Yes, absolutely. And to me, this really casts doubt on the notion that early humans were primitive and a long time went before civilization evolved. Because when you think about it, Homo erectus and some of these other so-called archaic or primitive humans were able to use fire and build tools and hunt mammoths and do all kinds of things that we would have trouble doing, they claimed 2 million years ago. And yet, during all that time, they never thought, hey, maybe we could save a lot of work by riding a horse or planting a farm or,
right,
or building a house instead of living in the cave all the time. It's just preposterous to believe that story.
I mean, well, our list of not so old things has a list of how old different cultures of the world think that civilization is by looking at their calendars and when their calendars began. And everything is in the range of a few thousand years before Christ. That's the whole world. All the historical records go back to, you know, a handful of thousands of years before Christ, and that's it. So
exactly. Yeah. I mean, everything makes sense in the Genesis time frame, but it doesn't make any sense if you think that people as smart and upright and capable as we are just sat around in caves for a million years before thinking about civilization.
The Neanderthal DNA, the genome, has been sequenced recently. And so at our article on Neanderthals at rsr.org/Neanderthal, we show the cover of a book by Ian Tattersall. He's considered one of the world's leading experts on Neanderthals. And in his book on page 10, and this was published in 1995, he writes that there is no good reason to doubt that Neanderthals were a separate species, you know, separate from Homo sapiens. And now that the genome has been sequenced, it shows that Neanderthals are closer to human beings than a chimp is to another chimp within the same chimp species. There are two species of chimps.
That's astonishing.
Isn't that awesome? And so Neanderthal are people.
Exactly. I mean, if you can interbreed with modern humans, you're the same species. Let's face it.
You're the same.
For a long time, they wanted to keep Neanderthals and the Denisovans and the Hobbitses and all these other things as other than us.
Right.
But if you can interbreed, you're all members of the same family.
Right. When I mentioned to Lawrence Krauss, he's, you know, occasionally on the Discovery Channel. He's an astrophysicist, very involved in evolution and the effort to figure out a biogenesis. And I said, Lawrence, Neanderthal, they're closer to us, their DNA, than a chimp is to a chimp. So they're people. And his response to me was, what is people? What are people? So we've been making a list, David, of the silliest things. Evolutionists say the silliest things. And that's just one of them. And it's relentless. When we've interviewed them, it's, what is evidence? What are people? It goes on and on and on.
Yeah, what is reality?
Eugenie Scott, what are problems? I say, Eugenie, isn't this a problem for evolution? She says, what is a problem? What are people? What is evidence? What? It's just too much. David, your website is so enjoyable to read, and we couldn't recommend it more highly. Crev.info, C-R-E-V. .info. Is there anything you're working on currently that you'd like to share as we conclude this interview?
I know you interviewed Dr. Henry Richter earlier this year, and I'm working with him on a book that'll have a lot of design evidence and tell his testimony of how he became a Christian.
Well, isn't that great? He is the NASA scientist who was so involved in our early space exploration. What an honor it was to interview Dr. Richter. And in fact, he scanned for us the first few pages of a NASA publication that he wrote decades ago. And so they're on our website also at rsr.org/Henry Richter, R-I-C-H-T-E-R. Just what an honor to know these scientists, David, and how much fun your life must be interacting with all these brilliant people, and you right there, right in the middle of them, appropriately so.
Yes, and I write articles for Creation Magazine sometime also.
That's right.
I enjoy these contacts, and I guess today was sort of like reading the funny pages of Creation Evolution headlines with the Just Little Stories.
Yeah, it was just the best. So, all right, thank you so much, David. God bless you.
God bless you. Thank you.
So thanks for tuning in. Remember our store, and you can also make a donation one time or monthly to help Real Science Radio stay on the air. And this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams in Real Science Radio. May God bless you. Intelligent Design.